Hey, everybody, and welcome back to another episode of Hail to the Keith, the historical-based podcast for all of those who just want a couple of nuggets to share at their next work event or their next family event. I am your host, Keith E. Langston, and you were just hearing to the stylings of one Glenn Miller, and that, of course, is In the Mood. And I am in the mood today to talk to you about kind of the sequel to my first Hail to the Keith, episode one, which was about the Great War. And of course, we're coming out at you with, much like a Marvel movie or any other Disney movie out there, the sequel, World War II. And, you know, this one had to be bigger, badder, more, I don't know, just bigger, badder, better. Not really, but there's going to be a couple of points that I want to bring out on this episode. Real different than your normal historical-based podcast on World War II, as I'm sure most people are aware. You can hear pretty much everything there is to know about World War II as far as the battlefields that were drawn and the battles themselves, and just, of course, everything is about D-Day and Pearl Harbor. You know, they say a lot of times history is written by the winners, and in this case here, I think that's 100% accurate, because most of the history that you hear about World War II comes from the American point of view, which I think out of the entire, all the countries that were involved in World War II, the United States probably came out on top. So there you go. But with that being said, there are a couple of things, and I think that I just want to point out that with my last podcast that I did, my last episode, I did kind of reiterate again that this is something for kind of just an overview. I mean, honestly, I could talk for days on World War I, World War II. I could talk for days on any of the great wars throughout history, human history. But what I think is interesting is to try to squeeze years of history into an hour-long podcast is really so that you can have just a couple of points of things to talk about. Hey, did you know that so-and-so did so-and-so? Some feedback I got, one of them from my good friend Schiffy Schiff, was that he wasn't aware of the Germans' attempts to get Mexico to kind of distract the United States in World War I. And I felt really proud that he knew that now. So hopefully I'll be able to shed some light on a couple of things here with World War II that we can talk about. And, you know, maybe give you a little bit of insight. And as always, please let me know what you think, how I'm doing, and reach out to me either on the Twitter or the artist formerly known as Twitter. But you can also find me on Facebook. You can also email me flounder824@gmail.com would be a nice way to get in touch with me. But please reach out to me mostly on the Twitter or the Facebook if you find me. But really, the first thing I want to kind of talk about is to pick up from really where we left off. And that has to do with the Treaty of Versailles, the 1919 Treaty of Versailles, that was signed, sealed, delivered, and really kind of destroyed the German Empire. So as I believe I explained in the previous episode, the German Empire, which was in Imperial Germany, the Second Reich, however you want to say it, Germany itself, that lasted from 1871 through 1918, so all the way up through the end of the First World War. After that point, Kaiser Wilhelm, he relinquished his crown, and what we're left with is what's called the German Republic, but it's more commonly known to and referred to as the Weimar Republic, which was in effect from November 9th to be exact of 1918 through March 23rd of 1933. And we'll get into that, what happens after 1933, in a little bit. It was a constitutional federal republic. For the first time in history, Germany had its own federal republic, which was now in charge of picking up the pieces from World War I. An interesting note here is we talk about the soon-to-be big, massive player in German politics. Of course, I'm talking about Adolf Hitler, and I don't think you can even begin to talk about the Weimar Republic and kind of the things that had happened in between from when Hitler first kind of gets introduced into this story up until when he kind of takes over all of Germany. Hitler's story, though, is very interesting because he wasn't originally a German citizen. In fact, he was born in the Austria-Hungarian Empire, and Hitler only really became, he moved to Munich when he was, his father had passed away. And a lot of speculation under that is because he wanted to avoid conscription into the Austrian army. So when he really went to join with World War II, with World War I, with the German army, it was, you know, he had been living in Munich. He joined up with the Bavarian army and served in the army throughout all of World War I. There's a story that goes around, it's, I believe it's disputed. There's a British soldier, Henry Tandy, who, when being interviewed after the Coventry Blitz, which was the blitz that took place over the British city of Coventry during the Second World War, he was said about, they asked him, a journalist had asked him about the story, saying he had, you know, what was your alleged encounter with Hitler? And he was quoted as saying, if only I had known what he would turn out to be, when I saw all the people and women and children he had killed and wounded, I was sorry to God that I let him go. There's no evidence, not even an anecdotal evidence, though, that anything happened, either that he was hounded or avoided after the claim. So it was, I believe the story goes that he had Hitler dead to rights as Hitler was coming out of like one of the bunkers in World War One, and he had just kind of let him go because I believe he was either injured. I think as the story goes is that he was injured or that he was unarmed or something. And, you know, in hindsight, you think to yourself, wow, if he was the man to have killed Hitler, what's going to happen? But you never know. And one of the reasons why you can say you never know what's going to happen is because we go back to 1919, after the end of World War One, after the Treaty of Versailles has been signed. Hitler is now a full German citizen, and he has limited education. He has limited career prospects, so he remains in the army. Now, in July of 1919, he is appointed the
Verbindungsmann
by the
Aufklärungskommando,
which is part of the
Reichswehr.
Okay, so that was just because I don't want to butcher those. I don't want to butcher them. So essentially, he's appointed an intelligent agent of the reconnaissance unit of the military wing of the Weimar Republic. One of the things he's assigned to do, he's assigned to infiltrate the German Workers' Party, which is, oddly enough, is what ends up becoming the Socialist Party of the National Socialist German Workers' Party, which is the precursor to the Nazi Party. He goes to these meetings. Now, he's supposed to just be kind of going in, finding out what's going on, and report back to the government on this. But when he starts going in, he's impressed by what he hears, and he starts kind of buying into all of their ideas, anti-Semitic, nationalist, anti-capitalist, anti-Marxist ideas. And he's actually told by his superiors to join the party. And within 1 week, he's accepted as a party member. And it goes from there. During this kind of period of time is when, you know, eventually Hitler become, you know, he gets arrested, he goes to jail, he writes Mein Kampf, he gets out of jail, and then he begins to start gaining power and taking over power. He becomes the party chairman of the, as I said before, of the National Socialist German Workers Party, and Hitler begins to amass a lot of power. Now, one of the things that helps expedite his rise to power, of course, is the Great Depression. And I know a lot of people think that the Great Depression was strictly a United States economic depression. That's not true. The Great Depression, while it did kind of suffer, the United States was hard hit. It actually is a global economic downturn that affected many countries from 1929 through 1939. Some of the countries that were affected by the Great Depression, of course, the United States is one of them, but some of the countries that people don't maybe even think about is Argentina, and that's decline in foreign trade hit Argentina hard. You had Australia. Australia had a dependence on agricultural and industrial exports, and it meant it was one of the hardest hit developed countries. Canada was harshly affected by both the global economic downturn as well as the Dust Bowl that hit the United States. A lot of people know about the, or, you know, remember about the Dust Bowl. Chile The League of Nations actually labeled Chile as the country hardest hit by the Great Depression because 80% of their government revenue came from exports of copper and nitrates, which were now low in demand. So Chile, China was largely unaffected by the Depression, mainly by having it stuck to the silver standard. So China was okay on that respect. A lot of the European African colonies kind of suffered from this. France suffered from the Great Depression a little bit later than other countries, really hitting it hard around 1931, instead of just in the late 20s, early 30s. But obviously, as we said, Germany was affected by it. Greece was affected by it. Iceland, India, Ireland, Italy, Japan. Latin America, there was a lot of countries in Latin America that kind of suffered from this. Chile, Bolivia, Peru, and you had the Netherlands, New Zealand, I mean, Persia, Poland. I'm really just going down alphabetically. Portugal, Puerto Rico, Romania. So as you could see, South Africa, the Soviet Union, Spain, Sweden, Thailand, Turkey, the UK itself, and the United States. So I think, as you can see, it was a global effect that caused a lot of problems. With that being said, it seems as though that one of the opportunities that came from this Great Depression was the Nazi Party, in that most Germans were kind of unaware of the Parliamentary Republic. And I think that when this kind of hit hard for Germany, Germany was easily swayed. A lot of the voters were easily swayed by the literature and the just what the propaganda that the Nazi Party was kind of spreading on here. Just to kind of give you a quick number here, they rose up from obscurity to win 18.3% of the vote in 107 parliamentary seats in the 1930 election, becoming the second largest party in parliament. So I think that proves that they were kind of selling a message that a lot of people were dying to hear in order to get back onto their feet. Once Hitler is able to gain power in the Reichstag, which is the German parliament, he ends up becoming elected chancellor. And there's kind of where he is. He becomes chancellor. And there you go. So now he's in power. We could keep going and talking about Hitler and kind of the atrocities that he committed. But I do want to move on just to kind of some other interesting facts that happened prior to the invasion of Poland, which is kind of what kicks off World War II. I want to talk a little bit about now the German rearmament process that took place. This is kind of creepy, or freaky rather. So one of the points of the Treaty of Versailles was that Germany was not allowed to rearm themselves. They specifically targeted Germany and said, we want to prevent another war from starting. It began small, secret, kind of just informal, but it was open and massively expanded once the Nazi Party came to power. Despite, though, that it being a massive undertaking, German rearmament was largely covert, and they used to do things where they used fronts, organizations like glider clubs for training pilots and sporting clubs to train pilots for their air force, using militia groups to kind of teach infantry combat techniques. They had companies that were set up, front companies, to finance the rearmament by placing massive orders with other various German companies so that they could all start to create weapons forbidden by the treaty. It was really amazing to read about that they were able to get this all done while under the guise of maintaining the Treaty of Versailles and keeping it all from the League of Nations. Of course, the League of Nations, for those that may not know or remember, the League of Nations was the precursor to the United Nations. It was the idea of the League of Nations was set up after, it was actually President Woodrow Wilson's idea to create a world government that could overlook and kind of be the focal point for peace and prosperity within the world. However, the United States did not back him on this, so the United States was actually one of the nations not in the League of Nations. So that was kind of, it was a failure by all means necessary, since it was designed to prevent a World War II, and it happened, we have a World War II anyway. But that's just, the idea that they were able to build, that the Nazi government was able to build and basically resupply themselves with weaponry and an army, a navy, an air force, is just unbelievable to me. In 1936, we kind of start seeing the beginning of the Sudetenland crisis, or the Sudeten crisis. 1936, the Sudetenland is an area in Czechoslovakia, or the former Czechoslovakia, and that was primarily kind of almost like a horseshoe shape, where it's filled with a lot of German-speaking Czechoslovakians. And there were a lot of these people that they would consider them, they were German Bohemians, Sudeten Germans, and they lived in this area, and they had been living in that area really around since the Middle Ages. After World War One, when the Czechoslovakia was created, they were part of that republic, but in 1938, Hitler started to basically become the advocate of these ethnic Germans living in that Czechoslovakian area, which he wanted to annex the Sudetenland. And that was kind of kind of the opening. I feel like as though that's the opening salvo to World War II, really, because at the time he was coming into a foreign country trying to invade it, take it over, annex it. British Prime Minister Neville Chamberlain, who was the Prime Minister prior to Winston Churchill, one of the men who is really kind of burdened with constantly appeasing Hitler, trying to keep him from going to war, trying to keep another war from starting. But when British Prime Minister Neville Chamberlain met Hitler on September 15th, he agreed to the secession of the Sudetenland. And 3 days later, the French Prime Minister did the same. None of the Czechoslovakian representatives were invited to this discussion, and Germany was able to walk away with getting the Sudetenland without firing a shot. That is, like I said, the beginning salvo, really, that leads us into September 1st, 1939, which is the invasion of Poland. And that is really, that's the opening strike of World War II. So when Germany invades September 1st, 1939, into Poland, and the United Kingdom and France actually declare war on Germany on September 3rd, the Soviet Union signs the Non-Aggression Pact with Nazi Germany. It's the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact, was signed on August 23rd, 1939. This is amazing, because what Germany had basically done is had said to this massive force on their Eastern Front, let's not touch each other. Let's just stay separate for a while, you know? And both Germany and the Soviet Union had lost land to Poland after the end of World War One. So Germany basically says to, you know, the Soviet Union, hey, listen, why don't we kind of talk about these spheres of interest that we have, which was Estonia, Finland, Latvia, Lithuania, Romania, Poland, and we can kind of talk about carving these up for the benefit of our own territories and political rearrangements. So that Hitler had basically his whole Eastern Front set. He's ready to go. He's like, I'm not going to have any problems with Russia. So there we go. So at the invasion of Poland, we have the Non-Aggression Pact. We should look at the allies and the axis of power that we have. So you have Germany, of course. They're allied with Italy under the rule of Benito Mussolini. And, of course, the Empire of Japan, who is under Emperor Hirohito. But the main general and prime minister at the time during the war was Hideki Tojo. So he is kind of he actually ends up being the one who is convicted as a war criminal at the end of the war. We can start to look at some of the different areas of war that take place during this time. We had talked about the invasion of Poland in 1939. Then there's also the battles of France that take place. So we have September 2nd of 1939, and tensions begin to flare with Germany as Britain and France put Germany on notice. September 3rd, France declares war. September 7th, French forces engage in light skirmishes with the German forces near Saarbrücken. And September 10th, British forces arrive to reinforce the French. Now, 1940 is kind of where everything starts to really heat up and get into it. May 17 and 18th, Brussels and Antwerp fall to the Germany. The Allies were forced to retreat to the coastline of France. We actually have on May 20th of 1940, German forces reach the English Channel, which pretty much, there you go. That's the Allied forces do try to counterattack the German forces, but they were repelled by another advancing German land force. You have the Luftwaffe bombs Allied defense positions around Dunkirk. So Dunkirk takes place pretty much in May of 1940, late end of May. You have May 28th, the King Leopold of Belgium orders his army to surrender the German forces, which does give the Allies the needed time to evacuate from Dunkirk. And I think you have on May 29th, 47,000 British forces are evacuated from Dunkirk, 6,000 French forces, and 120,000 Allied forces evacuate on the 30th of May. And May 31st, 1,500 Allied soldiers arrive, and 150,000 arrive in Britain. That's pretty much the up to Dunkirk. You go into June of 1940, and the German Luftwaffe bombs Paris on June 3rd. June 4th of 1940, the Allied forces begin to evacuate. And you have the Second Battle of France on June 5th, Germans striking south from the River Somme. You have the Germans launching an offensive on Paris on June 9th. Norway surrenders to German forces, and Italy joined the war by declaring war on France and Great Britain on June 10th. You also have June 13th, Paris actually declares an open city as the French government leaves and flees to Bordeaux. And June 14th is where German troops enter the French capital of Paris. And that's, I believe, when they walk under the Arc de Triomphe. And you have on June 18th, Benito Mussolini and Adolf Hitler meet in Munich. And that's when General de Gaulle tells the people of France on a broadcast from London to resist the Germans. So, yeah. And then you have on June 23rd or June 22nd, France signs an armistice with Germany. June 23rd, Adolf Hitler tours the captured capital of Paris. And on June 24th, the French officially surrender at Compiègne, which is the site of the German World War I surrender. So Germany pretty much doing a full 180 on the country of France from World War I. Moving on to some of the battles of the Atlantic. There's a lot of just different notes here that I'm reading regarding just a lot of the U-boats and the many, many boats that they sank during the course of that. I think it's important to say that the U-boats were really kind of tearing up the Atlantic and the coastline of Western Europe. Some of the information that you can see on the U-boats and also the battles that take place in the Atlantic is just, it's really interesting reads for anybody that's really wants to dive into it. There's a lot of great stories that are on there, and I highly recommend it. I want to move, though, to the Norwegian campaign, which is known really as the first direct land confrontation between the military forces of the Allies and which would be the United Kingdom and France against Nazi Germany. This runs pretty much from January up through June of 1940, at which point in June of 1940, the Norwegian military forces are ordered to cease resistance and demobilize. And by June 10th, a surrender is complete, resistance is ended, and now Germany has taken over Denmark and Norway. The Winter War, which is another major kind of arena of war, really takes place between the Soviet Union and Finland from November of 1939 through March of 1940. Now, this kind of starts back in pre-World War II, back in the end of World War I, where the Bolshevik Revolution breaks out and Finland declares an independence from Russia in December of 1917. There's a Finnish civil war that goes on, which is between German-supported White Guards and Soviet-supported Red Guards that takes place in 1918. But by July of 1919, Finland adopts a democratic constitution. Now, when Nazi Germany invades Poland, the Soviet Union also invades Poland, and then you begin to see this breakdown in the Baltic states where Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania all sign mutual assistance pacts with the Soviet Union. The Soviet Union then asks Finland to kind of join in with them, but Finland eventually they say no. You know, they decide to not agree to this. You then end up having, in November of 1939, Helsinki is bombed. Helsinki, Finland is bombed by the Soviet troops, and they cross the Finnish border. The Finnish Democratic Republic actually does make a plea to the League of Nations in December of 1939, asking them to kind of intervene in this, and doesn't happen. The most that happens is that the Soviet Union is expelled from the League of Nations because of their attack on the Finns. And that happens again in December 1939. So there's a lot of battles that take place in December, January, February. Again, this is like the Winter War. And so it takes place pretty much throughout the whole winter. By the time that we hit February, the Finns are now seeking peace terms. And there's a lot of battles there's a great area called the Mannerheim Line, and the Mannerheim Line is this fortification line that was built up by the Finns, and when the Soviets broke through that, it was kind of like, okay, it's time to end this war. So pretty much fighting. There's a lot of fighting in and around the city of Vyborg, and the Finns retreat from their last footholds or toeholds of the Gulf of Vipuri. And in March of 1940, there is a Moscow peace treaty that is signed, and a ceasefire goes into effect. So with that Moscow peace treaty, it does mark the end of 105 days winter war. Finland had seceded to the Soviet Union was just kind of some border areas, but they were able to hold their own. It is said that with these concessions that they gave to the Soviet Union really totaled only 9% of its territory. So the harsh terms from this Treaty of Moscow, however, does end up leading to what was called a continuation war between the Soviet Union and the Finnish. So it's like the second Soviet-Finnish war. Pretty much, it kind of continued on in 1941, this time by the Finnish and Nazi Germany. Once Nazi Germany was kind of ended their non-aggression pact with the Soviet Union. So it was kind of a pause for, I guess, a while period of time. It was a pause on that. If you move down to the North African campaign, where there were lots of battles between the Axis and the Axis powers and the Allies in places like Libya, Egypt, Morocco, Algeria, Tunisia, and Ethiopia, which Benito Mussolini and Italy had invaded in 1935. I think that one of the unique characters to just quickly mention is General Erwin Rommel, or Rommel was known as the Desert Fox, and he actually had a lot of successful battles as well as just a successful siege in Africa. His North African campaign was pretty notable for, you know, his battles in the African campaign. So you may want to check that out if you'd like. Now, there are certain things that I want to bring up regarding the battle on the Eastern Front. And really, I want to start with Operation Barbarossa. And that is the invasion of Soviet Union by the Nazi Germany and many of its Axis allies. It started on June 22nd, 1941, and it lasted all the way through to December 5th of 1941. This is considered to be the largest and costliest land offensive in human history, with around 10 million combatants taking part and over 8 million casualties by the end of the operation. The operation, which was named after a 12th century Holy Roman Emperor and Crusader, Frederick Barbarossa, it puts into action Nazi Germany's ideological goal of eradicating communism and conquering Western Soviet Union to repopulate it with Germans. Now, this goes against, obviously, the signed political pact that they had with the non-aggression pact between the two of them. So it's kind of like, okay, what's going on here? Well, it opens up the Eastern Front for Germany. At this point in 1941, Hitler felt he had the Western Front kind of under control, and he was, you know, marching further and further west and conquering cities and taking over capitals and land and countries in the mainland Europe. So they decide, okay, we're going to start fighting a two-front war. And they invade the Soviet Union. Now, this couldn't have been any worse for them, because why? Why would you do that? Hitler believed, he's actually quoted as saying, we only have to kick in the door and the whole rotten structure will come crashing down. That's how little he believed in the Russian Empire. Or the Soviet Empire, I should say, at this point, the Soviet Union. And really, it was also quoted as the purpose of this Russian campaign is the decimation of the Slavic population by 30 million. So Germany really thought that they were just going to walk right in and take right over. However, they didn't realize that they were going up against a monster in his own right in Joseph Stalin. Joseph Stalin's primary goal, I think, was to just continue to send wave after wave after wave of Soviets into harm's way to prevent the Germans from advancing any further. You can look at just different battles that took place in several of the different areas, such as the Ukraine and southern Russia and the Baltic countries and Belarus, and just really kind of see where all of this damage had taken place and where all of this has just come into play. The Soviets really just, they didn't care. They did not care, and they were willing to just do whatever it took. One of the many stories that you hear is of how they would basically burn their entire land to the ground as they were retreating. And the reason being behind that is because they did not want any of the German army to be able to stay in any confined area for too long. Again, I mentioned the continuation war between German and Finnish troops that continued on through in 1941. You have into the winter months where you start to have that, you know, that cold Russian winter starts to affect the German troops. And it really just doesn't end up being good for any of the Axis powers. And they end up having to retreat really after kind of the last battle, which is, I believe, the Battle of Moscow. And once that's ready to go, it's over. It's a Soviet victory. It's the end of Operation Barbarossa. It's the beginning of the Soviet counterattacks. Germany fails to seize Moscow. And I think at that battle itself lasts 3 months, 1 week and a day. And at the end of it, you have total losses of German casualties in 174,000, you know, but you also have 581,000 missing, killed, or wounded Soviets. So the amount of numbers that they were just willing to throw in front of the Germans is just insane. Some other major important battles to talk about and look into as well are starting in 1942. You had Operation Blue, which was the Axis's summer offensive to capture the oil fields in the Caucasus, and had a later goal of capturing Stalingrad was on there. Operation Blue kind of went from, it actually went from June 28th through November 24th. And ultimately it was a operational failure by the Axis powers. You also have the Battle of Stalingrad in July 17th through February 2nd. So July 17th, 1942 through February 2nd, 1943, considered to be the bloodiest battle in history. And that ends up being a Soviet victory, a total Soviet victory. Destruction of the Germany's 6th Army and 4th Panzer Army. The destruction of Italy's 8th Army and Romania's 3rd Army and 4th Army. And destruction of 99% of Stalingrad. So that's where I'm saying is just the Soviet Union had no problem with destroying the land that their own people lived on in order to prevent the Germans from getting anything in regard. The Eastern Front really continues on all the way up until 1945, where there's April 16th through May 2nd is the Battle of Berlin. It's 9 days of street-by-street fighting. You have the Battle of Halbe, which was a battle that lasted from April 21st through May 1st, which the German 9th Army was destroyed as the fighting force by the Red Army. And it goes all the way up until the death of Adolf Hitler on April 30th. You have May 7th, you have the unconditional surrender of Germany, and May 8th is the end of World War II in Europe. There's a lot of people who will say, in looking back, that if it wasn't for the Soviet Union, at the very least, joining with the Allied powers, that World War II would have been very different, at least in the Battle of Europe. And I don't think that you can overlook the horrendous crimes against humanity that Joseph Stalin and the Soviet government performed on its own people, and also the people that they deemed not as worthy. And in wartime, you can't pick and choose. Well, you can pick and choose, but sometimes you end up, you know, the enemy of my enemy is my friend kind of thing. And I know that Winston Churchill had said that when the Allied powers had marched into Berlin, that he had said we should have just kept going all the way to Moscow. And I think it was better, you know, cooler heads prevailed, because they didn't want to just continue on with this battle, this war that had cost so many lives at this point. So that's kind of where we end with the Eastern Front battles. There's just a couple of keynote things I want to talk about before we get into the end of the war and D-Day and things like that. And, well, I guess D-Day is a good place to start. So, most people have heard about D-Day and the invasion of Normandy on the western coast of France. Most people know about that Operation Neptune, D-Day, Normandy landings, whatever you call it, whether you will. However, one of the key aspects of that was also the military deception, which was codenamed Operation Bodyguard, and to mislead the Germans as to the date and the location of the main Allied landing. Now, within that, there was Operation Fortitude. Operation Fortitude was actually headed up by, was in part, one of the commanding officers for that was General Patton, George Patton. And what this essentially was, it was the Allies' attempt at just kind of deception over by allowing different things to happen, so that it was kind of a unique defensive strategy. It was kind of broad. It was, I guess you could say, maybe Operation Quicksilver, or Quicksilver was the code name for it. And there was different phases of it. And it was had, you had Quicksilver 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6. And the plans for this were great. So Quicksilver 1 was a leak. And it said the basic story of Fortitude South was to be leaked under Quicksilver One, largely through the Double Agent Network and some diplomatic channels. You had Quicksilver Two, which was a wireless traffic. Radio deception was used to simulate the movement of troops across the south of England, with German listening posts expected to pick up the traffic. You had Quicksilver 3, which was physical deception, a display of dummy landing craft, including associated simulated wireless traffic, road signs, and restricted areas. So they were really, they were setting up dummy tanks, dummy airplanes, inflatable tanks. Like, there's actual video of them kind of having one, you know, one soldier like flipping the tank over because it's just an inflatable tank. And then having like inflatable dummy craft that was like sitting around so that they could, you know, just have it be out there for when they were doing flyovers. You had Quicksilver 4, physical preparations. An invasion target would have been prepared with attacks in advance of landings. And so Quicksilver 4 covered a number of air activities, including bombing of the Paz de Cali beach area and tactical railway bombing immediately before D-Day. Quicksilver 5, which was, again, physical deception, overall increased activity around Dover, such as by giving impressions of extra tunneling and additional wireless stations to suggest that's where the embarkment was going to be. And Quicksilver 6, again, more physical deception, night lighting deception to simulate activities at night in places that dummy landing craft were situated. So one of the, I guess you could say that part of the success of the Normandy landings was also attributed to this Operation Bodyguard, which was misleading the Germans to knowing where the main Allied landings were going to be. The weather on that day for D-Day, though, was not ideal, and the operation actually had to be delayed for 24 hours, and a further postponement would have meant delay of at least 2 more weeks, as they had to, they were planning it based off the phases of the moons, the tides, the time of day, and everything like that. So anything, any more delay in that, they would have missed their opportunity. But with the invasion of D-Day, the Allied troops start to take back mainland Europe. And with that, you start to move west. They start to move east, getting ready to meet the Soviets in Germany. And the end of the war happens. I didn't really mention D-Day. I mean, I didn't really mention Pearl Harbor. And the reason for that is because I think that, again, much like D-Day, it's kind of been beaten to death. I feel like people always know about that. I really wanted to talk more about the Operation Fortitude. I just think that that's really cool that they enacted this huge deception plot to kind of throw the Axis powers off their tracks. I think you could do a whole show. I know I mentioned Hardcore History on my previous show, but there is a great Hardcore History series on the Pacific Battle and the Pacific War, and I highly recommend listening to that if you're into that. The battles that take place in the Pacific Theater, they're just as exciting, just as interesting, just as educational as anything that took place in Europe, and in Africa and Asia, Western Asia. I think I would recommend looking into it, really, if you want some more. I'm kind of glossing over it because, again, I think it could be another hour, 2 hours of any high points there. But it is, I mean, it's really eye-opening as well. If you start to kind of like read the adult versions of those stories and adult versions of that information, because you start to learn of, and I know I mentioned the word atrocities a few times, but you really start to read about the atrocities that the Japanese committed on not only the Americans, but also the Chinese, and then any of the other people that they were engaged in warfare with. I'm also leaving out the heinous acts committed by the United States with regards to the internment of the Japanese Americans who were American citizens. And to my knowledge, I don't think we were intern, we weren't putting any German Americans or Italian Americans in jails or internment camps. So there was this, a lot of this kind of racist bigotry towards Japanese Americans, dare I even say Asian Americans, who the American government probably felt were threats to our way of life. And I would be remiss to say that that is something that you should look into as well, because it wasn't a great time. And you know, there's a lot of horrific stories that come out from those, that period of time as well. With kind of the war coming round, you know, kind of winding down, we start to look at the aftermath and what's going to happen. Now, obviously, having had World War One been surrounded by the problems of Germany, and now World War Two having problems with Germany, Germany can no longer stand as the way it is. And you end up having this split of Germany into East Germany, West Germany, and also the capital of Berlin split into East Berlin, West Berlin. Now, when we start to look at what happens there, the first thing you need to know is that Germany was really split into four parts. And it was really split because the Allied powers of France, the United Kingdom, the United States, and Soviet Union kind of all wanted their peace. So you end up having the Federal Republic of Germany, which ends up is West Germany, and that's the West. It's the capitalist. It's the, you know, starting to rebuild as a, I guess, for lack of a better word, capitalistic society, a federal republic. They move the capital there to Bonn, as the city of Bonn becomes the capital. And you have that area of Germany, the western part of Germany, starts to be very prosperous and starts to have, you know, come back from basically almost total destruction and starts to become a powerhouse as far as, you know, in politics and political, in the political theater. You have East Germany, which is under the Iron Curtain or under the control of the USSR, the Soviet Union, and that is called the German Democratic Republic, East Germany. Their capital still remains in East Berlin, and that really turns itself, it's just a communist state, socialist workers and peasants, and really it's just another opportunity for the Soviet Union to kind of advance this, I said this Iron Curtain, it's a term that's coined by Winston Churchill, and it's really just this whole dark, literally dark cloud that kind of reaches across all of Eastern Europe, and a lot of the Eastern European countries that extend at that line is just really, it starts to have that heavy influence of the Soviet way of life. And the Soviet government really kind of stretches its hand that far out. The Eastern Bloc is pretty significant into the Cold War and into the late 1940s and then into the 1950s and 60s and up. So you have this split. They're not reunited until the Berlin Wall falls in 1990. And I think when we talk about, we should talk a little bit about the Berlin Wall. The Berlin Wall, which was fully built in 1961, was a, you know, concrete wall, and it separated the West Berlin area, which was the Federal Republic of Germany, from East Berlin, which was by the German Democratic Republic. And the construction of the wall, it had guard towers, it had a wide area known as the Death Strip that contained like trenches, beds of nails, other defenses. And the primary intention for the wall's construction was to prevent East German citizens from fleeing to the West. There were times where the West had to do airdrops into Berlin, into West Berlin, because there was not an opportunity for them to get food. And it was really part of it was kind of one of those, almost those like trigger sites, you know, where there could have been some serious actions that took place because of the Berlin Wall. So when the Berlin Wall finally came down, it was really showed, I think that was the real end of the Cold War and the end of Soviet aggression. There were different presidents from the United States, John F. Kennedy, Ronald Reagan spoke at the wall. There's a great video of David Hasselhoff, I think, playing on the wall on the West Germany side, on the West Berlin side. And there's actually a big chunk of the wall is in the JFK Museum in Boston that I've been to, that I've seen. And it's kind of cool. You can actually reach over. It's behind like a little, well, last time I was there, it was behind like a little rope, like a velvet rope. Ooh, the velvet rope. And you can kind of put your hand on it, and it has like, it has the graffiti on it. And it's kind of cool to see. And it's kind of like when I remember going when I was younger and putting my hand on it and thinking to myself, wow, I'm actually touching a real piece of recent history. And kind of in retrospect, it wasn't as big of a deal for me now looking back, because when I went to Rome last year, or 2 years ago rather, and I got to put my hand on the Colosseum and actually walk in the Colosseum, thinking to myself, that's real history, you know. But the Berlin Wall was real history, you know, and that was something that, unfortunately, I think could easily happen again, where we could end up in a place where some of the countries that we are dealing with today could blow up and we could end up turning into something like this. You know, history is constantly repeating itself. And I think sometimes we do look back at certain things and say, you know, we're never going to let that happen again. I mean, mainly when we talk about topics like the Holocaust. And I think that even though with all good intentions of never letting these things happen again, whether it's another massive world war or another heinous act like the Holocaust, after World War II was the creation of the United Nations. And the United Nations was, as I said, it was the successor to the League of Nations, which was specifically made to prevent these things from happening. And I think that with this, we could very well, it could happen again. I mean, like I said before, history repeats itself. And unfortunately, I think something like this could happen again. And we could be looking at that in the near future. Hopefully we learn from our mistakes. Hopefully we as a world, we as a society, humanity, whatever you want to call it, learned from our mistakes and knows that we can't do this again, that our country, our world is just too fragile. And because now we're looking down the barrel of nuclear engagement. And I think that was something during the entire era of the Cold War that was always very prevalent, is like, hey, the next battle that happens, it's going to be nuclear, and we need to not have that happen. So hopefully there is no mad mutually assured destruction, and we can move forward into a peaceful and cooperative world as they have in Star Trek, maybe. So, but with that being said, I think that wraps it up for this episode of Hail to the Keef. Once again, I want to thank you for joining me, and I hope I gave you a little bit of information to talk about at your next party or event. If not, please let me know. Again, you can reach me at Flounder824 on the artist formerly known as Twitter. You can hear me every week on GFA Live with my BFF, Petey Winston, where we talk about classic wrestling, and that you can find on any of your other podcatcher apps or podcatcher feeds. But also on the North-South Connection Podcast Network, you can hear A La Carte with Keithy, the other show that I have that comes out every other Friday, and anything else. I'm usually on the Exposition, which is on the Jenny Position, the foremost X-Men podcast. You can hear me on Chronoso Monthly, where I usually review a match or two with my buddy JT, and just hear everything else we have to offer here on the North-South Connection Podcast Network, as well as the Backbone feed coming in now. So please check us out, and take care. Have a great day. Bye-bye.